As a forum listener, you recognize the importance of these timely and provocative conversations on the day's news and culture. If this service makes a difference to you, why not help us keep it free for everyone by texting KQED to the number 90999 on your mobile phone to donate $5. Message and data rates may apply. Terms at mgive.org/t.
Good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels. Coming up, everything you ever wanted to know about hacking. What does it mean? Who does it? How does it work? And what's the relationship to the WikiLeaks scandal? We'll talk with Joe Menn, a reporter with the Financial Times and author of Fatal System Error, a hard and imaginative look at the world of opportunists many of us have a hard time understanding. And we'll try to explain in terms a non-hacker can understand what's behind this phenomenon and if it can be stopped. You can join us with questions and comments. It's all ahead here on Forum. Good morning. This is Forum, and I'm Spencer Michaels, in for Michael Krasny. The dynamics of hacking into computers is probably a mystery to most of us, but we hear about it constantly, most recently in the WikiLeaks controversy. WikiLeaks may not be a perfect example of hacking, we'll sort that out later, but there are plenty of other instances where somebody, spies, criminals, bored kids, nations, university professors, maybe even journalists, gain access to other people's information by gaining access to their computers. How do they do it? This hour, we'll talk with Joseph Menn, a reporter for the Financial Times, stationed in San Francisco. He covers cybersecurity and other technological issues, most recently WikiLeaks. And he's the author of Fatal System Error, The Hunt for the New Crime Lords Who Are Bringing Down the Internet. That book has just been reissued in paperback. He formerly worked for the LA Times. My aim this hour is to make this world that's affecting all of us understandable to the non-expert. So welcome, Joe Menn. I've heard you explain hacking in pretty basic terms. Let's start by trying to define what hacking really is.
Well, I guess in legal terms, hacking is the unauthorized access into a computer that you don't have any right to get into. So that's fairly straightforward. The ways that it happens are pretty varied.
And can anybody sit at a computer who has enough technological knowledge at any computer and try to hack into somebody else's computer?
You can try. It's not trivial. I mean, it takes some actual skill, though there are enough programs available on the web that you can – you know, they're what are called script kiddies, where it doesn't take any serious skill. You just download the right stuff, and then you try and apply it to somebody else's computer. You send them a baited email. You use various basic tricks.
Well, sending an email, excuse me, seems like the main trick. But are there other ways you can gain access to somebody else's computer?
Well, sure, and they're sort of escalating levels of sophistication that are needed for a lot of them. I mean, the way that most people get hacked these days are when legitimate websites are compromised, either through malicious advertisements that, you know, appear to be for a car or a stereo or something like that, but are not that are swapped in there, and you know, tiny little images can send your browser, your web browser, to someplace it doesn't think it's going, and you can have your malicious programs downloaded to your machine very quickly that way.
Now, we all use this terminology, downloading malicious programs, malware, spyware, all this stuff. But is there any way to really describe what happens inside the computer, or is that just too complicated to even talk about?
Well, some of the worst stuff is pretty simple. You get a program on your machine that records every keystroke, and most of your keystrokes are pretty boring to criminals because most of this is about making money. Most of this is organized crime. But if they record keystrokes that include, say, your bank logon name and password and account number, that could be pretty dang handy for people.
And this works within the computer using programming. Is that the basic thing?
Yeah, and then it sends that stuff off to somewhere else. They have to send the data somewhere. And that can be one way it's stopped, with firewalls that not only check what's going into your computer but what the data that's leaving your computer.
Could you do this if you had a mind to?
Spencer, I was an English major. I don't think I could.
But you know a lot of people who can.
Yes.
And is it essentially a technological skill that they have, or can you go read a book and learn how to do this?
You can definitely read a book and learn how to do this. What's interesting is that this has always been it is getting easier as the stuff in your computer gets more complicated, as it has more programs, more functionality, it gets easier to do something that it wasn't intended to do. And I think that's one reason that people like smartphones and they like the iPad and things like that, is because they actually have more limited functionality, which makes them safer.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
So is that – well, let me get into this, though. What's going on in this field now? I mean, everybody is aware that hacking is a problem. Is there more hacking going on now, or are there more defenses going up to prevent it, and is it becoming harder?
I think it's much more prevalent. The problem is that not only are you more likely now to have a computer that's infected than you were 4 years ago, you're much less likely to be able to know that you've been hacked. And the sort of bad stuff that's getting on your computer is much likely to be worse. It's more likely now to be one of these keyloggers that's after your financial information, and that they intend to run up fraudulent charges on your credit card or drain your bank account if they can. They're much more likely to do that. In the olden days, the comparatively mild old days, you know, your computer would stop working very well. It might spew advertisements at you, or they'd use it in the middle of the night to send spam around the world, you know, none of which was, you know, affecting your bank account.
They'd use my computer to send spam around the world?
Absolutely. So the key criminal tool out there are what are called botnets, which are a collection of compromised PCs, the vast majority of whom the owners have no idea there's anything wrong with their computer at all. And they first gathered those up in 2003 and so to spread spam, because there were blacklists that were preventing given computers, known computers that were bad, from sending spam. We're not going to receive any traffic. We're not going to accept email from this internet protocol address. So they said, well, okay, now we've got thousands of computers and you can't ban them all. There's nothing wrong with, you know, Henrietta in Poughkeepsie, but her machine was sending spam.
So you call these botnets, B-O-T. What's the derivation of that?
Bot, short for robot.
Robot.
Yeah. So these are robot computers. They're also called zombies. They're all sorts of drones. They're all sorts of colorful names.
And so somebody sitting somewhere else can more or less take over my computer, your computer, and use it to do something malicious.
Yeah, they're probably not aiming for you personally. That's the sort of more sophisticated hacking that we're seeing nation-state sponsor, that sort of thing, corporate spies. They're looking for any computer that has a given vulnerability that's well known, and they'll spread they'll just infect as many as they can, and then they'll control them remotely. And initially, these botnets were used to send spam, and then they were used for denial of service attacks, which are back in the news, which is generally not very sophisticated. It's just that all of these computers, these drones, are pinging a website to try and log on at the same time. They're doing a few other tricks, and that can crash a website so that regular people can't get to it.
All right. I want to find out about denial of service attacks, because that seems to be pretty basic, and it's crucial to your book. Just to remind people, we're talking to Joe Menn, who's the author of Fatal System Error, which is a really interesting book about the hunt for the new crime lords who are bringing down the internet, as it says on the cover, just recently out in paperback. So a denial of service attack is a situation in which you get a whole bunch of computers to work for you to send some message to a site, and it overwhelms the site because so many people are trying to get on it that it puts the site out of business. Is that essentially right?
Yeah.
And your book talks about how gambling sites were attacked this way. Tell us why.
Yeah, it's really funny. So I was I was covering this stuff for the Los Angeles Times in 2003 and 2004, and denial of service attacks were occasionally in the news back years before that, when Yahoo would go down or eBay would go down, and people would be kind of stunned initially, and it turned out to be a denial of service attack from some teenager in Canada or something like that, somebody just doing it for the heck of it. But it got much more sophisticated. It got more organized, and again, initially because of these spammers who were largely in Eastern Europe, the summer in the U.S. And then they said, well, we have these botnets to send spam. What else can we do with them? And denial of service attacks, as I said, are technologically not all that tricky. And I was looking for the victims of these, and it so happens they went after these gambling websites, which seems sort of odd because, I mean, frankly, the guys behind these are basically organized criminals, and then they're picking on companies which in many cases are affiliated with organized criminals in our part of the world, which seems like a tougher fight than necessary to fight, a tougher enemy to pick. But they were doing it for extortion. They were saying, you know, your website is down, you may have noticed. Please send us $40,000 via Western Union to Latvia, or your site will stay down on Super Bowl Sunday. And they picked on these guys because, one, they were often in Central America and other places with poor infrastructure, so it was harder to defend. Two, they were a cash business and understood the penalties of downtime, particularly around a big sporting event. There's plenty of competition. They would just lose those customers. And third, they're highly unlikely to go to the FBI or similar authorities for help because, at least in the U.S., these sites themselves are considered illegal. So it was mob-on-mob action.
Did it work? Did they pay up?
Yeah, it did work. They got a lot of money from these sites. But some of them hired this guy in California, a security whiz named Barrett Lyon. And Barrett Lyon became the key to the book.
Well, you say a security whiz. He was a young kid who hadn't ever done this before, essentially.
Well, he had done it in the earlier day, a few years earlier, but he was all of 25 when I met him in 2004.
So he came in as the knight on the white horse. He went down to Costa Rica, I believe, huh?
Yeah.
And tried to save this gambling site that was getting hit by all these attacks.
Well, he did. He wrote some good software. He got some new infrastructure up and running for them. He saved them, and then he saved a bunch of their competitors and other companies. And that was sort of interesting. But what was really interesting is that he sort of went above and beyond the call and tried to figure out who the bad guys that were doing this. I mean, he wasn't really getting paid to do that. He was getting paid to protect the companies. But his ego got involved, and he wanted to actually see these guys sent to jail. And that is something that basically never happens.
So it's really hard, it seems, to trace who's sending you anything if they don't want you to know, right? I mean, that's one of the things about the internet. It's so anonymous.
That is a major, major problem and advantage for the internet, depending on how you look at it. But from a law enforcement perspective, it stinks. I mean, if you were trying to design the internet to make attribution difficult, to preserve anonymity, to make authentication impossible, you really couldn't have done a better job. I mean, it is almost impossible, but not completely impossible.
Well, this guy Barrett did it, right?
Yeah, he did. So what he looked at the programs that were running on these drone computers that were attacking his clients, and there was a certain configuration where he could see where they were getting their orders from, where else they were connecting. And they're connecting to something called an internet relay chat channel in Kazakhstan, of all places. So he logged onto that chat channel and pretended to be another bot master, a bot herder, somebody else who had his drones, and said
– Another crook.
Yeah. And he said, well, gee, you know, my drones are connecting to your channel. What's up, you know, what's up with that? And, you know, most of the hackers over there speak English. And most of them didn't trust him, and they kicked him off the channel. But over a period of months, he earned their trust. He said that, well, you know, I'm a bad guy. You know, I've got my viruses. I can maybe update yours. We can combine forces. We can do more attacks together. And he eventually got an actual real name, first an IP address for one of the bad guys, and then an actual name and address. Ivan Maksikov was the name.
And in order to do this, I mean, you and I couldn't do this. This is really complicated stuff.
He did some nice stuff.
But essentially, it's programming that he's doing, right?
Right. No. Yes, he's a programmer, and there's a lot of, you know, detective intelligence and understanding of other people that's involved as well.
So this guy that he found in Kazakhstan, you say?
He was actually in Russia.
Oh, this guy was in Russia.
The chat channel was in Kazakhstan.
And what happened?
Well, that's where it gets dramatic, because sometimes when Western companies are attacked, they are able to get some information on the bad guys. It doesn't happen very often, but sometimes it happens. And then they give it to law enforcement, and law enforcement says, oh, great, and they file it away. You know, a lot of them try hard, but the truth is that 90% of serious internet crime goes overseas, and it's almost impossible to get anything done overseas. There will be an occasional headline when there's a wonderful cooperation and arrest in Germany or France or England or someplace that actually likes us. But when we talk about the Ukraine, especially Russia and China, it generally doesn't happen.
You're saying the cops, the FBI or whatever the equivalent is, or Interpol or anybody, doesn't work very well in this realm.
No, it doesn't. International legal cooperation, even with our friends, even on less complicated cases, is really hard. And now we've got different laws over there. In many cases, in some of these countries, at least until recently, it wasn't illegal to hack into – there were no laws on the books that said it was illegal to hack into another country's computers. What made this case so special is that for a while, the United Kingdom had a really terrific sort of ecumenical outlook on cybercrime. And instead of just trying to bust down doors and arrest people, they realized that this is going to be a big issue and they need to – help people by whatever means necessary. And maybe that's educating them. Maybe that is getting new laws passed. Maybe distributing software that helps them. Maybe connecting them with people like Barrett that can protect companies. They had this very big view. And they realized that they needed help from these other countries. And before they needed help on any given case, they would send agents over there, take the head of the cybercrime unit in Latvia or wherever out to dinner and say, you know, do you need any computers? What's your favorite kind of wine?
Vodka.
vodka in many cases. How can we help you? And so that when push came to shove and they did have a red ball case they needed help on, they could call their friend Ernie or Netsky or whatever and say, look, you know, we got a big case. Can you help us stake out this Western Union tomorrow? I'm on a plane.
So it worked to some extent in this case.
It did work. In this case, I don't want to give away the entire book, but it went to Moscow. They sent an agent to live in Russia for something like 3 years. They needed not only – and the first 4 months, they really wouldn't give him the time of day. They had him sitting in the wrong office in the wrong part of the MVD. But there are a number of adventures. He was almost killed at one point. By corrupt people working with a police department that was a bit dirty, which happens fairly routinely over there, and it took the intervention of the British Foreign Secretary. I mean, it was an amazing case to get three guys. They arrested three guys. They were sent to prison for 8 years, and bizarrely, nobody ever put out a press release about it. But it's in the book.
But it is in the book. It's a fascinating story. It's just a great tale. I guess the question comes up, though, okay, they got three guys. They spent 3-4 years working on this thing. It's a drop in the bucket, huh?
Exactly. Yeah, it's all a trick. This is what we creative types like to call a narrative arc, and I guess pretty much everybody else would call a happy ending, and that they actually – there's some satisfaction, which is very rare in cybersecurity. But the real point of the book is why they couldn't get more guys, why this is an outlier. This was supposed to be the first of many such great cooperations, in this case between the UK and Russia, and then sort of everything went to hell. I mean, among other things, they tried to go upstream and get worse guys. And they kept running into official protection, unofficial protection, not just because of garden variety corruption, which is pretty mind-blowing over there, but eventually because around the same time the folks who were running Russia decided that these same sorts of criminals could be pretty handy if for political purposes, for attacking other countries, dissidents within Russia, et cetera.
Which brings us, in some respects, to this whole concept of cyber war, which is a concept that nations can use cyber war against each other. And there are several instances that have been reported on where they have Israel, Georgia with Russia, Israel with Syria. Is cyber war related to this cyber crime we're talking about?
Yeah, and there is a lot of there's so much mushy thinking and rhetoric about the idea of cyber war that in many ways it's not useful at all. That it needs to be broken down. There are several things happening at once here. There is organized. I mean, there's garden variety penny ante cyber fraud, which you know isn't very interesting unless you're a victim of it. There is organized organized crime, which is a big problem and one that's underestimated because banks and others don't like to talk about how pervasive it is and how little they can do about it. And then there is state-sponsored espionage, which is a big deal. But espionage has been going on for a long time. And then there's stuff that's actually, you know, blowing something up. And that doesn't happen very much. It has started to happen this year with the worm that infected the Iranian nuclear enrichment program. The worm is called Stuxnet. And that is a big deal because that is a computer program that actually managed to do some harm in the physical world, not just shutting down communications networks and websites with these denial of service attacks, which is what happened in Estonia and Georgia, but actually messing up a physical process. That's pretty interesting, and unfortunately, we're going to see more of that.
Well, you said, though, that maybe cyber war isn't a great concept. There seems to be some difference of opinion on that. Richard Clark wrote a book called Cyber War where he mentions all these attacks by one nation against another, and then other people don't think that those are valid examples, and maybe cyber war is overhyped. Where do you come down in this thing?
I think it is good that people are paying more attention to this. Maybe you have to talk about the possibility of planes falling out of the sky before you get Congress and the American public to realize that there are serious threats. So the education the education level going up is good. There is all sorts of turf war going on in Washington. Should the NSA be protecting us? Should the Department of Homeland Security be protecting us? Should Washington stay the heck out of this entirely? There's all sorts of good, important issues there. There is plenty of overhype, in part by folks that are hoping to get and are getting, you know, really nice fat government contracts to advise them on this stuff. What's really happening now, with the exception of Stuxnet and some pretty impressive corporate espionage against places like Google, the organized crime is what's happening now. And the problem is that in many parts of the world, organized crime and government are close enough allies that it gets sort of hard to distinguish one from another. So the same criminal networks that are mostly worried about lining their pockets will also do things on behalf of the motherland, be it Russia or China.
There's also a thought, though, that the United States may not want to get into this prevention too hard or attack somebody else because the United States is the best at this because we can hack into them better than they can hack into us. Is that playing a factor here?
That's a huge factor. I mean, we have very good cyber arms capabilities. We don't like to talk about what they are, but we have very good offensive capabilities. It's Russia and China that have wanted some sort of UN construct that regulates cyber arms the same way that nuclear weapons are regulated. And the U.S. historically has opposed that, in part because we don't want to fess up to what we have or forswear their use, and in part because it's very hard to verify that the other side is doing what they say. If they say they're not going to use something, we can't fly a spy plane, you know, over Russia and identify, you know, what they're doing on their computers. And in addition, they can continue to outsource to criminal groups their weapons.
All right, we're going to take a break in just a second and continue our talk with Joseph Menn after the break. Joseph Menn is the author of Fatal System Error, and he's a reporter for the Financial Times, and it's a fascinating subject of who's doing this. I want to get into that. I mean, seems as oh, and if you want to make a phone call to us, it's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. I'm Spencer Michaels in for Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels, and we're talking about Fatal System Error, a book by Joe Menn about the hunt for the new crime lords who are bringing down the internet. It's just out in paperback, and it's a fascinating story, and there's all sorts of implications about it. If you want to join this conversation, we'll take some phone calls in a little while. 866-733-6786. That's toll free, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. Joe, the one of the things that prompted this discussion, in fact, is the whole WikiLeaks controversy. And I've heard various opinions as to whether WikiLeaks really relates to all of this hacking that we've been talking about and breaking into computers. What do you think? I mean, that seems to be the basic question here.
Well, a few things on that. First of all, Julian Assange is a hacker. He was a hacker, pretty good hacker, but he wasn't breaking into people's computers to steal stuff that didn't belong to him. In this case, he appears to be acting much more as an avant-garde publisher, and somebody else took information they weren't entitled to.
He's like a conduit, isn't it? I mean, this private in the army who downloaded this material gave it to WikiLeaks.
Allegedly, Private Bradley Manning gave him a great deal of information that Manning wasn't supposed to be doing. So that's not – it is being conflated with these sinister hackers who are out for badness and to steal things. But he is acting a lot more like the New York Times would with the Pentagon Papers or something. You can say he's not a very – he's a publisher you disagree with, but it seems to me in this case he's acting much more as a publisher than as a hacker himself.
Then the whole question comes up with the WikiLeaks as to what the role of the computers has been in this, and whether anybody's really at fault, and is there really a First Amendment issue here? I mean, that seems also to be really important.
It's a fascinating story. I mean, there are many different issues. There's clearly a First Amendment issue, which has to do with the nature of publishing and how that's changed. In terms of sort of classic hacking issues, I think governments have been very surprised that they can't just wipe out a website if they don't like it. The Senator Lieberman and others have been jawboning U.S. technology companies that provided support to WikiLeaks, and they suddenly discovered that there were terms of service violations and they didn't really want to be hosting WikiLeaks, even though WikiLeaks has not been accused in court of any crime. So you have – which is the sort of thing that happens
– but it's certainly been attacked in rhetoric, in political rhetoric as treason and all sorts of things.
And he's been called a high-tech terrorist.
Right.
He's been called – there have been calls for his assassination. There is very, very heated rhetoric on this. But he's not an American citizen. And even if he were, there are First Amendment protections that come into play. So it's, you know, it's weird. It speaks to a lot of people's, I think, subconscious fears about or semi-conscious fears about mad evil hackers. Maybe it's the hair. I don't know.
which is actually brings up an interesting point that I wanted to get to earlier. We're talking about rings of criminals in Russia who are doing this to make money. To blackmail people, to giving them money. And we're talking about countries attacking each other to louse up their radar, for example, or whatever. But we're also talking about, you know, what you just said, just some sort of strange hacker, some 21-year-old kid sitting in his basement having fun. Is it all of the above?
Well, yeah, it's all of those things, and it's going to be more of all those things. I mean, so Assange is distributing information in new ways and much more rapidly than folks are used to, as opposed to, you know, one diplomat leaking a few cables to the New York Times, the Washington Post. Suddenly, you've got somebody leaking 250,000 cables, and so it's more about sort of it's really more about distribution. Both of information and of tools, than of anything else. What's interesting is that one of the attempted suppression of WikiLeaks, which isn't going terribly well, has angered a lot of folks mad at the companies that revoked their support for WikiLeaks. And so you have, among other things, a bunch of teenagers loosely formed together in a group called Anonymous, which previously wasn't known for very much besides maybe attacking the record industry websites over piracy issues. And they were attacking Amazon and MasterCard and Visa and all these other sites. And so they're using denial of service attacks, which we were talking about earlier, only now it takes even less skill to launch that. You don't have to be a criminal in Russia with your own botnet. You can voluntarily participate, sign up your computer essentially to participate in these denial of service attacks.
All right, let's take a few telephone calls, and we've also got some interesting emails, a couple of really interesting emails. But let's take a telephone call from Tim in San Francisco. Hi, Tim. You're on Forum.
Hey there. Joe, I got a question for you regarding your coverage of these Russian gangs and stuff. One is, have you gone to Russia to cover this? And I understand it's really dangerous to be a journalist in Russia. You know, they have like the highest rate of killed journalists and whatnot. So what's your experience on that end of working on these stories?
Thanks, Tim.
All right.
I went to Moscow to report for the book. And it was a pretty hairy experience, to be honest. In the beginning, I was hoping to get actual cooperation because on its surface, this is a happy story about the MVD, which is like the FBI over there, working with Western authorities and catching hackers. And they want good press. And to them, it was a big deal when they put these hackers away. It was on national news in Russia. It just didn't make it over here. So I was hoping that they would cooperate with me. But they ran it by the FSB, which is the old KGB, which is pretty much the de facto power in the country. And after I asked too many questions of the wrong people, the FSB told the MVD that I was probably a spy, and under no circumstances should I talk to them, should they talk to me. And after that, I was watched everywhere I went, and I had to meet with people in safe houses where we didn't think we were followed. It was pretty scary, and I was glad to come back.
Did the U.S. government want to hear what you had found out?
Yeah. The U.S. government was interested in what I was doing. They it's one of the things I've learned from reading the WikiLeaks cables is that it's not a lot of fun working for the U.S. embassy or other agencies in Moscow. Their houses get broken into. They get harassed. They get phone calls saying that their loved ones are dead. I mean, it's pretty cold war these days.
All right, let me read a couple of emails here. David in Palo Alto says, you should point out that for the most part, malware, viruses, keyloggers, and other bad programs only work on Microsoft Windows. One of the easiest ways to avoid all of this is to get an Apple Macintosh or a Linux computer. Is that by that?
Yeah, that's by and large true now, though the great majority of people do not want to run Linux. You have to have some sophistication to do that. It doesn't take a lot of sophistication to run Apple products. It is true for now, but it is largely because of market share. Because the bad guys do capitalism better than we do, and they devote their resources to writing viruses that are going to affect 90% of the world's computers instead of 10%. But as Apple gains market share, they will be increasingly targeted. There have been bad things that spread on Apple products. There will be more that target the iPhone as it grows in popularity. It is safer to run Apple products now, but that is not a guarantee, and it will be less of a guarantee going forward.
So we have a question from Gary in Tampa, Florida, who is interested in who these people actually are. Gary, you're on Forum.
Well, actually, it's not not that I'm looking to ask who they are. I just wanted to really make a statement in regards to the guys on Anonymous and how they are not everyone. The comment before was that they are all teenagers or et cetera. Anonymous is far from just being entirely teenagers. There's a number of different guys. I mean, there's a lot of guys that started in the MIRC cult, et cetera, that are on there and distributing whatever it is that they're distributing. But the main comment I really wanted to put out there was when you have senators and congressmen, et cetera, like Joseph Lieberman coming out and saying that, WikiLeaks is Julian Assange has put the troops in danger, et cetera. Actually, the argument should be that actually Julian Assange has done nothing more than expose who actually has put the troops in danger and the lies and things that have gone on around that. I mean, there are, of course, noble causes with the wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq, but a lot of the exposure that was done actually put maybe Joseph Lieberman in a bad light, and hence his arguments against what is going on here.
Gary, let me just interrupt you and ask you a question, and maybe Joe can join in as well. You started out by talking about Anonymous, which Joe described as a group of people who are attacking some of these sites. What is Anonymous?
Well, it's actually a group of sites that...
Go ahead.
Essentially, everything bad that comes into the Internet basically starts there. You know, and anything that is, I mean, it's true. It's just really, it's a gathering place for a lot of people that are, you know, a little less of a moral character. But there are those there that also, you know, take a look there for, you know, there's a lot of technology, et cetera, that's passed in, you know, amongst the people there as well. And it's in a lot of ideas, et cetera. And one of those ideas is that the LOIC, the LOIC, the low orbit ion cannon, which is what we were talking about before with the DDoS attacks.
It's over and my head.
The denial of service attacks, distributed denial of service attacks. And, you know, somebody in one of those forums essentially created a simple installer for that particular device, where previously it took people, you know, quite some time to figure out exactly how to do that, and they just made it easy. And then came out with their Twitter feeds and their Facebook pages, et cetera, and said, okay, this is where you're going to attack at whatever time. So that's really what goes on
a
lot.
So you don't have to answer this question, but are you a member of Anonymous?
No, actually, I'm a little older for that now,
I thought you said they weren't all teenagers.
Well, they're not. I mean, I can say that I know people that are on there, and you know, I got my start early on doing, the computer world was adventurous early in, you know, it's still adventurous, obviously, and you know, when you were an expert or at least somebody who was better than somebody else in that particular world, you know, you were looked at as something high and mighty. And actually, Julian Assange, I was having this conversation with somebody yesterday, is really turned into somebody that you know, essentially the king of hackers. You know, it's what every hacker really wants to be, out in the public, known as a hacker,
all
without
right,
having to say it themselves.
All right, Gary from Tampa, Florida, thank you for your call. Joe Mann, what do you think about it? It sounds like there's a whole other layer to this story.
As I was telling a friend of mine, the story is a hydra. You know, you think you report out one part of it, and then three more spring up. Anonymous. So, I mean, what was the question? Anonymous was affiliated. It's largely teenager. It was affiliated with a board site called 4chan, which is lots of graphic stuff and is about pranking people and making them look at gross things. And you know, it's what's interesting is that an everyday kid or young adult can do a form of technological protest.
Against
whatever they call it, the hive mind thinks that they should attack. So you can pick your own targets. You can download this program. You can be an English major. You can download this program and it'll attack Amazon or MasterCard for you. And if you all agree on what the target is, then it can have some impact.
Wow. Okay. We have a telephone call and an email, more or less on the same subject. The email says, does antivirus software like Norton and McAfee protect computers from being botnicks, and how effective are they? And we have Bob in San Rafael, who's kind of got the same thought here.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Bob.
Hi. About every day, I just delete about 20 or 30 emails from my spam folder. And every so often, I'll send a reply saying, get your botnet crap out of my email spam box. And 2 days later, I'll get a message saying, we couldn't deliver your message. Is there any way to block this stuff that doesn't have a traceable ultimate sender's address? I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you. Joe?
Is there any way to block an email that doesn't have a sender's address? You mean to make sure that the stuff in your inbox, you only get stuff in your inbox that is coming from actual people as opposed to bogus?
I think that's what he meant, yeah.
No.
No. Well, what about the question from the
Does antivirus work?
Yeah, does antivirus work? Software.
It's good at some things. It's a good thing to have. No, it does not protect against all of this stuff. Some of the antivirus suites, which offer which cost more money and do more things, is worthwhile. But the garden variety. The grind variety stuff is based on what are called signatures, where they look at the same, this infection happened in Arkansas, and so we're going to look for this kind of program on your computer and stop it. The problem is that the bad guys are way ahead, and now they have stuff that morphs so that every infection is different, and so a signature thing doesn't really work. The White House cyber czar, Howard Schmidt, told me that consumers are basically – they've lost. It's over.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Is there anything that you or I can do on our home computers to make sure that our stuff that we put on there is secure?
There's a whole bunch of stuff that you can do and you should do. But the most important thing is a mindset change where you can't assume that you haven't been hacked unless your computer does something weird. You should assume that you have been hacked or you will be hacked. You should not put sensitive financial information on your computer if you can possibly avoid it. You should think very carefully about – you should never use a debit card online. If you use a credit card online, you should go to established retailers, not use it all over the place. The reason is it's easier to recover credit card fraud than debit card fraud. The percentage recovery is much higher. You should run –
What about banking online?
Well, let's put it this way. The FBI late last year put out an advisory to small businesses saying if you're banking online, you should have a computer that it does nothing else. You shouldn't read news. You shouldn't do email. It's so easy to get infected by this stuff. That you should have a computer that does nothing but bank online. So that should give you pause.
And if you bank online, if somebody attacks you, what, they can transfer money out of your account?
Yeah. Yeah, and it takes some work. I mean, because most folks won't allow, if you bank in San Francisco and suddenly you're transferring $10,000 to Moldova, your bank might not like it. So what happens is the money is transferred to somebody in Chicago and there is a what's called a money mule, who thinks he's doing something else, probably thinks he's doing something legitimate. He's an accounts processor, and he takes the money out there, and then he wires it to Moldova. But it's a major underground industry right now.
All right. If you want to join this conversation, we're at 866-733-6786. That's toll free, 866-733-6786, to talk with Joe Menn, author of Fatal System Error. It's an amazing, kind of scary situation. I went and listened to you once talk to a group of bankers who were trying to figure out how they could prevent this. And there was this company that said, well, we can look at your accounts and see if anything unusual is taking place, and we can get in there before that money goes away. Is that approach you think work?
Yeah. So there's this sophisticated behavioral analysis, defense in depth, layered protection. There's all this fancy stuff that looks at everything that's happening at a given bank. There are too many transfers going through here, and there's this and that, and it tries to draw all the dots together. What's interesting is that, I mean, that's the sort of program that is deployed by intelligence agencies and then the very biggest banks and folks like that. And it hasn't really gotten down to, Ma and Pa's Community Bank. Those guys don't have it yet.
But that's who was at that meeting that you spoke at and I was at.
Well, they are looking for an affordable means to do that. This is fairly sophisticated stuff. It doesn't always work, but it helps a lot. And it's got to get down to their level. It's not there yet.
All right, let's take a call from Ken in San Francisco. Hi, Ken. You're on the forum.
Hi, two quick questions. I'm loving the detail in this show. I'm wondering who the actual good guys are in the story of hackers attacking these gambling websites that are basically in violation of the law themselves, where they're located, the people they take advantage of with this gambling that's raised it to gambling on steroids to take advantage of people losing money, which are usually the poor. And then question two is, Have corporations or the feds used hackers or done it themselves to go on these BitTorrent-type sites to go after people sharing movies? Have they used sort of a rendition form of going after people more covertly than they've announced publicly?
Interesting. All right. Thanks.
Well, rendition is sort of a loaded word.
Yeah,
I don't think any people uploading Rolling Stones songs have been grabbed off the streets of Italy and sent to Egypt. I'm hoping that won't happen. The U.S. cares a lot about intellectual property and piracy, and the U.S. and those industries which are the movie industry, the record industry, well, not the record industry so much anymore. The movie industry has a lot of clout. They've got a lot of money. They spend a lot of money in Washington. It's a major export for us. The U.S. spends a lot of energy and time working on anti-piracy stuff. The consumers don't have as that powerful a lobby. You are more likely to see if there is a U.S.-Russian or U.S.-China cooperation and some people are rounded up and sent to jail. It's interesting to me that it's more likely to be some software or movie pirates than it is some hackers breaking into people's bank accounts. That might have something to do with, the way the power structure works in this country. As to your first question as to who the good guys are, I mean, that's when I decided I had a book, Barrett had deliberately infiltrated the Russian cyber mob, and as it turns out—
Barrett, as you recall, was the guy who the gambling interests hired to try to sort out where these denial-of-service attacks were coming from and how to stop them.
Right, and his first clients were these guys who, turned out to be affiliated with your classic American five-family mafia bad guys. So he deliberately infiltrated the Russian mob, and he was sort of blind to the fact that he was also getting inside the American cyber mob, which is, to be fair, way behind the capabilities of other folks. Our side, our mobsters need more of a congressional bailout, so we'll be truly competitive. But rather than walk away, he did a Bridge Over the River Kwai number, and he wore a wire on his own backers. There are some fairly dramatic stuff there. Those guys are not good guys. The Russians are not good guys.
How about Barrett?
I think Barrett's a pretty good guy.
He took a lot of risks.
I'm not going to give you an address. He's made a lot of people pretty mad. He's actually on his fourth startup now. And he's got fortunately he can now he's doing very well. Unfortunately, he can now afford a pretty state-of-the-art alarm system.
And he's a Bay Area guy, I believe. Yeah, that's interesting. All right, we have an email from Joe. From Scott in Sacramento. Joe, isn't it remarkable that we are now talking about the same weapons being used against corporations by foreign states as against the U.S.? We are discussing war between non-state actors. If someone used a bomb against Amazon, would we be discussing it?
I would say that would be news. I would be happy to discuss any bombs being used against Amazon. This is all asymmetric. The stuff that's interesting to me is that this is very asymmetric. You have nation states attacking U.S. companies very often. We haven't talked a lot about it this hour, but this was the biggest year ever for cybersecurity. You had in January Google disclosing that agents apparently with the backing of the Chinese government, and I do go into this in the book, had breached their defenses and walked off with some of their source code. If a company like Google, with the sophistication of Google, is getting hacked, you can pretty much assume that your company, if it's of any interest to what world powers want, is getting hacked too.
Well, what's the purpose in your mind? If China is sponsoring hacking of Google, why would they do that?
There is an angle where they're looking at dissident information. They want to track people inside China and that sort of thing. But it's intellectual property. There is an ongoing enormous drain of intellectual property from the West to China, and it happens in many different ways. It has, you know, the joint venture requirements if you want to start a business.
When you're
saying
intellectual property, you mean the Chinese government wants to find out how Google works so it can use those algorithms itself? Is that what you're saying?
Sure. So that information winds up in the hands of homegrown competitors like Baidu and others. It's mercantilism. It's helping your local industry one way or another.
All right. We'll take a call from Arthur. We're winding down on time here. Arthur in Palo Alto. Go ahead.
Yes. People have been proposing being able to vote on the internet, particularly for overseas and military voters. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the risks of that, in particular with respect to the pilot that was done in October for this voting. In particular, a team from the University of Michigan, led by Professor Halderman, in the University of Michigan, hacked it within a few hours of that, and was able to break in and completely vote and change all the votes as they wish to.
All right, thanks, Arthur. We'll take an answer here from Joe in the minute and a half we've got left.
Yeah, a lot of the electronic voting machines have turned out to be very hackable, I find it really alarming. We don't have the sophistication yet to be able to do that. I don't think in a safe and secure way. I mean,
there aren't any real instances in this country of somebody trying to change elections, are there? We don't have much time left.
Not that I know of, but that's the problem, is you don't know if it's happened. There aren't any paper ballots to go through in most cases. In some cases, that's a requirement. I think that would be a paper backup would be a pretty good requirement.
All right. So there's lots of implications to this whole mess we're talking about. It's fascinating. Joseph Menn is the author of Fatal System Error. An updated version in paperback is just out, The Hunt for the New Crime Lords, who are bringing down the internet. He's also a reporter with the Financial Times. Thank you very much, Joe. It's a terrific subject, and I think you're on to something really good. You've been listening to Forum on KQED-FM. I'm Spencer Michaels. Stay tuned.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.